I just want to let you know what's going to happen, and then we'll bring up Diane Bilyak. After her set, Stephen Gadbois will play, and then we'll start with the feature time. First, Rich Mungo and Bob Phillips will play as part of that set, and then Judith Christensen's set. And then after that, Deborah Strathis will be the next performer, and then Perry Desmond Davies, if she gets here in time, Cheryl Perrault, Rob Forsese, and then after that, I'll do that jam thing I was talking about, try to get some folks to play, and we'll see who else shows up or whether we bring some folks up again. One thing that I like to do at this open mic is have us really take good care of the staff. They take excellent care of us. And so I thank them. So thank you, Savory Lane. And thanks for humoring me. Okay, the performer coming up, her name is Diane Bilyak. I heard her once at the Emerson Umbrella open mic, and I was very, very impressed with her writing and also impressed with her as a performer. Please give her a big welcome, Diane Bilyak.
I don't need the light. Nah. I think so, yeah. All right, well, thank you so much for having me, Ellen. I don't know where she went. Everyone's so talented here. It's really fun to listen to everyone. Okay, the first thing I'm gonna do is a bit more serious. I do write poetry, I'm working on a book, and I've been writing other things as well, so. I don't know what to do with this. I think I'm going to have to hold it. Maybe not. Yeah, there's a light, but you know what? I don't know if that will help. It's just sort of it's hitting this thing. So I think that's good. That's good. All right, great. Okay. It's called Town, and so Nancy, you sang a song about coming from a place that you've been in for a very long time, and that's what this is going to be, hopefully someday, a very long poem, a prose poem about where I'm from in Connecticut. Okay, so it was published in a magazine called Memoir so it's in three parts. So part one, I'm from town. To be from town, maybe you don't need years trailing behind you, but town would have to enter you in some way so that wherever you went, you compared every other place to town. And every time you left, you knew precisely when you'd be coming back. I have a tribe in town. It's the one I started with. The buoyant nature of town supports and carries me. It has not left the inside of me. I have learned to trust things for their consistency. All increments of change are so measured that when filtered through the strainer of settled and familiar people, it's as if nothing happened. Nothing was indefinite when it came to town. I knew exact places, roads, and the landmarks along them. The span of the lake from the height and bend of Village Hill. The exact moment to hold my breath on Seven Sisters Road. The exact smells of my neighborhood that would waft up between houses and trees. I knew my neighborhood in the light and in the dark as if I were stationed there to guard it. Part two. Town hems in my longings. My anxieties are inflated and depressed by town. Like a dog, I learned my territory by fences of smell and jolts of electricity. If I leave, town sickness with its fevers and convulsions overtakes me. As I age, I'm starting to look more like its landscape, particularly those stone walls hidden in old fields, covered by trees and brush. Useless now, entropy has toppled them into unstacked beauty. I am not trying to be elusive, but I am troubled. I've refused all calls, which indicates I am not at home in my own body. I have declined love for this town, but I have my town to keep me warm. Despite these losses, at least I've retained the ability to be self-mocking and witty, which, as luck would have it, rhymes with self-pity. The backdrop of town and its ability to usher in memories and beliefs about times, passing, and solidity are what's kept me safe. I adhere to these flawed theories. I stand on one of town's many hills to oversee the recurring battle waged between the enemies called false hope and overarching fear. As they duke it out, I remain fixed, or should I say fixated, or perhaps asphyxiated. There is a street in town housing 16 structures, and that street was our grounds. As in holy, as in cemetery, as in play, as in stomping and estate, we did it all there, and we held our ground too. We were grounded by it. Then one of us vanished. This showed us the transparency of our corporal selves and the way flashlights pressed against our open palms would distinguish our veins through man-made illuminations. Now, loss loomed like the moon eclipsed by Earth, and joy was forced to radiate only a faint hint of light around the mass in front of it. Soon after, we lost two more, one to the swift death of his beaten heart and the other who drained bottles hidden in the slender cabinet near the sink. All this before anyone avowed that how you vanished was by hanging yourself. We were not allowed to utter your name for years. We were like the Hebrews and their distilled and unmentionable God. At first, I dared to say your name aloud. I tugged at the back of shirts, stepped on heels by following too close, and made a nuisance of myself. I was shushed and glared at until I finally gathered that you were just gone. And the quickening air of my first grief, this new wind, was a gust that spun into a tornado. But really, it was more prosaic than that. It was the absence of your laugh and your voice, which had been absorbed by the atmosphere around me, like a stray echo in a vast canyon. Thanks. That poem is very heavy, I forgot. But after this, it gets lighter, and so I'm just gonna ask if anyone here, now we call them tag sales in Connecticut. Do you call them tag sales, garage sales? Tag sales, okay. Well, I used to be a total addict, and so I wrote this kind of to make fun of myself and some of my family members as we go out to tag sales, and how I kind of prepare like a tag sale every year to get rid of my stuff, and I make something like $18, and I'm totally thrilled because I can go to dinner that night. Okay, so this is called Tag Sale, and it's just sort of advice on how to do a tag sale. This is sort of a passive-aggressive guide to having a tag sale. I used to be a hardcore tag sailor until I ran out of space, and so now I resell it. Since tag sailors are an actual breed of people, let me mention some of the most common types to watch out for. First, there are the early birds, or as we call them in my family, the vultures. These are the people who swoop in way before your official opening. Do not sell them anything. It only encourages bad manners. Next, there are the miserly bullies, who assert, no matter what an item is priced, you really expect me to pay a dollar for this piece of crap? I'll give you a nickel. Don't be fooled by someone's age or the way they look. I've had people who've parked their Mercedes in the yard, and ladies who looked like Mrs. Claus talk to me that way. And finally, watch out for the hardware sneaks. These are the guys who rummage around your garage asking if any tools or mowers are for sale. Even if it's very clear that the area is blocked off, I suggest you lock it. Over the years, I've gathered other hints for your big day. Number one, arrange your tables in a horseshoe so people can walk in and outside of them. Velvet ropes are a nice touch, but then you have to hire a doorman or a bouncer, which means you're losing money before you even start. Two, choosing prices is a psychological mind game. If you have even one item, It could be your half-eaten donut that you've put down for a second, and it does not have a price on it. You will be asked how much it is more times than you can count. Therefore, put a price on every item, or throw stuff in a box and write $1 each. Any cheap stuff you want to get rid of, you can put in another box and write free on it. The vultures will scarf it up. 3. Don't price items $5, $10, $15 because people will offer less to feel like they're getting a bargain. Instead, price items a couple bucks more and then settle for the price you really want. I don't know what number I'm on. If anybody does any unreasonable haggling, such as offering half the price, keep a big hammer on hand and smash the desired item in front of them. Then say, now you can have it for nothing. 6, do not sell them the hammer. 7, most people are courteous and shop during the allotted time, and they also haggle less. Afternoon is garbage time, and people are looking for quantity on the cheap. Try doing the fill the bag trick because it means you won't have to cart as much stuff off later. 8, the fewer things you have left means less work in hauling it back inside or to the dump. Leftover items with value can be sold on eBay. The rest should go to the swap shed, which is the place at your local dump where usable items can be left for others. Note of caution. Within seconds of pulling into the dump, a type of amber alert system is activated. Since the swap shed is the headquarters for the same vultures you saw only hours earlier, a variety of vehicles will suddenly arrive and lurch toward you, slamming on their brakes. The only bonus is that this swarm is that they happily empty your car for you. This is particularly helpful if you are a recovering tag sailor like myself, who has been known to fall prey to the mysterious swap shed fever. One too many times, I've left there with more than I came with. On Saturday, Cheryl and I and some other ladies read for a benefit, and I've been working on these longer stories about my sister and trying to put it together as a book. So this is sort of the introductory one, and it's in a memoir form, and so it's called Damn Yogurt. My only sister is 45 and has a condition called Down syndrome. We're Irish twins, born less than a year apart. For 4 days each May, we are the same age. She currently lives in a supervised apartment where she considers herself to be a staff person and not one of the clients, as she's known to call her housemates. Over the years, I've heard many derogatory terms attributed to her condition, and sometimes, based on her behavior, I add my own and refer to her as a liar and a thief. Considering her intellectual capabilities, she is a virtuoso in these disciplines. She assumes that she can outwit people simply through repeated and persistent denial. But later, since she often processes every thought out loud, I can usually find out the truth if I hide nearby and listen. For example, one time she was confessing, "Yeah, so what if I took Uncle's cell phone? It's mine now." When I yelled out, "I heard that," she answered, "What? I didn't say anything." Then she added, "Besides, I wasn't talking to you." Her life of pilfering began early with the persistent acquisition of pens. My sister carries around a plastic bag of them wherever she goes. If I dare to borrow one, she'll peer into the bag to find the perfect pen, which means the crappiest one that also works. As I start to use it, she stands over me like a hornet hovering over a morsel of food and repeats in her voice, "Are you done with it yet? Are you done with it yet? Are you done with it yet?" Once I lost my patience and said, "Does it look like I'm done? I haven't even written a full sentence yet. Besides, you probably took this from me back in high school, so I might not even return it." This caused her to release an audible gasp, followed by a few whispered swears. But moments later, when I gave her the pen back, she said, "Thanks, darling. It's about time." Besides pocketing pens, she's often been in trouble at her many job placements because she works around food. To think she's qualified for the food service industry simply on the basis that she loves to eat has not been the best tactic. At one job, she was spoken to for her habit of stopping by the bakery and leisurely grabbing a cup of coffee and some random baked goods out of the case. It seems that the ladies who worked there would occasionally indulge her, and my sister wouldn't quite get that when Dottie or Gloria weren't in, the muffins were not free. When I got wind of this, I sat with her and tried to instruct her not to take these items. Using good old-fashioned guilt mixed with intimidation, I said, "Repeat after me. I just can't take the muffins. I like the muffins." I said, "But that's stealing. You have to pay for them." "I've got money," she answered, and then added, "Besides, you're not the boss of me. I'm older than you." I blurted with exasperation, "Not even by a year. Just say you won't take the muffins." It was a verbal shakedown, and she was breaking me as usual. She's both good cop and alleged criminal, so sly in her apparent innocence, but also a relentless and shrewd evader of questions. Finally, I just kept repeating, "Are you going to take the muffins?" And the answer was never no. Just a series of yeses and one or two maybes that in their honesty made us laugh. And I knew in my heart those baked goods didn't stand a chance of staying in the cases. But my favorite work story involved a 6-ounce container of yogurt. About a month after the muffin incident, she'd moved on to the dairy case. She took a yogurt and went straight back to the break room. In mid-swallow, the manager came, and she was busted. He threw away the evidence, and she was promptly let go. I imagine my sister was more upset that they didn't let her finish that yogurt than she was about being fired. For a while afterwards, she would often walk around the house and raise her fist to the sky. We'd hear her slowly mutter these two simple but poignant words, "Damn yogurt." It was as if in her mind she felt it was the yogurt's fault, as if to say, "You nasty yogurt, you dairy case temptress, you have ruined me for the last time." Since then, most of her jobs involve cleaning. As a professional student and a part-time writer, I really shouldn't point my finger at her. I didn't complete a resume until I was over 30 and haven't had a full-time job since I worked one summer at the DMV. Plus, I'm not innocent. I've taken my share of file folders and pens and duplicated personal documents using the office copy machine. The difference is that I know how to lie and steal and get away with it. In truth, I suppose neither of us are meant for the working world. We are a bit more creative and freewheeling. We're the morale boosters, the one most likely to go off for a snack. For that reason, I propose that establishments resurrect the medieval practice of having a court jester. Therefore, instead of being frustrated or penalized at work, we could legitimately be paid for the comic relief we now provide for free. Just before my sister was relieved of her duties at the damn yogurt store, our cousin Dee Dee was shopping and observed her with her work buddies gathering carts outside. About 5 or 6 of her peers surrounded her, and she was telling some story with her distinct flair. In a flourish to signify the end, she suddenly raised her hands and gave everyone a complimentary high five. As they basked in the wake of her glory, she slyly waltzed away, leaving her grinning coworkers behind to collect the rest of the carts. Entering through the whoosh of the automatic doors, she mused to herself and out loud at the same time, "My work here is done." Thank you.
Please, a big hand for Diane Biliak. That was wonderful. Excellent job. And I'm hoping she'll get a website, and maybe we can at least put out a mailing list, and you can, if you're coming this way again, you can let us know. That was just wonderful. Thank you.